on Business and Labor for May 1st, 2013. And I also open a public hearing on Senate Bill 96. Representative Thompson. And Jan, if you want to go through and summarize what the bill is.
Madam Chair, committee members, this measure allows qualified self-insured employer groups to apply for an exemption to the requirement that self-insured employers provide DCBS a security deposit for payment of compensation for injuries to workers. And the bill defines what a qualified self-insured employer group is. It is a employer group that is a municipal corporation or a public corporation. And there are no amendments before you.
Okay, fine. Senator Thompson, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Doherty.
Good morning.
The rest of the committee, how's everybody today?
Peachy keen.
Oh, everybody's smiling in good shape today. thanks for the opportunity to introduce Senate Bill 96. This is a straightforward bill that allows a self-insured group that represents primarily cities and counties to have the same opportunity currently available to individual self-insured cities and counties. As a high-level summary, the bill allows a self-insured group a chance to prove their ability to pay workers' comp claims without incurring the cost of procuring a letter of credit. Instead, the self-insured group will need to satisfy certain conditions and receive approval from the Workers' Comp Division of DCBS. Lynn McNamara, the Executive Director of City County Insurance Services, is here to follow later to explain the details of the bill and how it will benefit them, because I'm not going to touch that. I'm sure Rep. Kenmer knows about those issues. But as a former Hood River County Commissioner, I understand the value that the organization like City County Insurance Services provides to over 98% of the cities in Oregon and 78% of the counties. This bill was unanimously approved by the MLAC board and comfortably passed in the Senate. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce this bill, and I urge the committee to support passing this on to the House floor. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Senator Thompson?
Hope not.
Yes, any technical questions of Senator Thompson?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have Lynn McNamara and John Schultz, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. To give you some background on this quickly, you probably already know that all Oregon employers are subject to ORS Chapter 656, the Workers' Compensation Law. They must provide assurance to their subject workers that they will receive compensation if they're for their compensable injuries, if they're injured on the job. Employers can purchase insurance from an insurance carrier, or they can become self-insured under Oregon law. And the department determines the qualifications to become and remain a self-insured employer. To qualify for self-insurance, employers must meet certain criteria, including having the financial ability to make certain and prompt claim payments that are due under the law and administrative rule, as well as assuring they can meet the costs for making those payments to administer those claims. The law currently allows cities and counties to request an exemption from the security deposit requirement and instead keep a loss reserve account, which is money that's set aside specifically for the payment of compensation to injured workers. Currently, five self-insured cities and five self-insured counties have obtained the exemption from the department to maintain a security instrument. The law allows individual cities and counties to apply for the exemption, but not group self-insured employers. This bill allows a self-insured employer group that's made up primarily of cities and counties to apply for this exemption from the security deposit requirement, and if approved, the group would be allowed to maintain a loss reserve account instead of posting a security deposit. The Management Labor Advisory Committee, as you've already heard, has reviewed this bill and supports it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Maybe Ms. McNamara can go, and then we'll ask questions.
Okay. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Lynn McNamara. I serve as the executive director of CIS City County Insurance Services, which is a service program of the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties. CIS operates a workers' comp self-insured group on behalf of its members, and right now we have 224 cities and counties and other groups that they create, but 90% of them are cities and counties themselves that participate in our workers' compensation program. We have a dedicated loss reserve. CIS is a public corporation that files audits with the Secretary of State. And in short, we would meet all of the qualifications, at least to apply for an exemption from the security deposit, but the law doesn't currently allow self-insured groups to do that, only individually self-insured cities and counties. So Senate Bill 96 would expand that opportunity to request an exemption to self-insured groups that meet that public corporation or municipal corporation criteria, which means you file an audit with the Secretary of State. To do this would really save money for the members of our program, which is the primary reason we're seeking the legislation and supporting it. We pay for the letter of credit, and in addition, it basically is going out for a loan every year, and you have to go through a great deal of administrative work to do that, and you have to post collateral far in excess of the security deposit that the Workers' Compensation Division requires, so that with the ability to apply for that exemption and potentially get it, we would be able to save money for our program, and these days every dollar counts. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Kinnamer.
I was looking at some of your testimony and couldn't figure out how much money this likely saves.
Madam Chair, Representative Kinnamer, the actual cost of letter of credit for us right now is $6,000,
right,
but we have to post collateral of $1.8 million above the $7.1 million that the department requires, and that takes it out of our ability to invest with the rest of the trust funds. So that it's a cost in that regard, and of course the administrative cost of going through the process of getting the loan each year.
Madam Chair, second question.
Please.
But it's not right to multiply that 6,000 times 224 entities.
Madam Chair, Representative Kenner, no. It's a flat cost.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I notice this applies to municipal corporations or public corporations. If there were a private self-insured employer group, does that already exist, or this would not apply, or they would still not be qualified to make this request, I guess, to be exempt?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, private self-insured groups do exist, and this bill would not allow for it would not remove the requirement that exists today to post a security deposit that exists for private self-insured groups. So this bill would not apply to private groups.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, those were the only two that were signed up. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on Senate Bill 96? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 96 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 190. Jan, if you could summarize.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee members. This measure allows the Workers' Compensation Board to adopt rules providing for electronic transmission of filings, reports, notices, and other documents. There's no amendments before you. Senate Bill 190 was approved by MLAC and passed the Senate 28-0.
Okay, thank you. We have one person signed up, Abigail Herman.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Abby Herman. I am chair of the Workers' Compensation Board, and I'm here today to present testimony in support of Senate Bill 190. This bill would amend an existing statute, which is ORS 656.726, Section 5, which pertains to rules. Currently, this statute allows and empowers the board members to make and declare all administrative rules which are required in the performance of their duties, which includes the rules of practice and procedure relating to hearings and board review proceedings. And these rules are found in Chapter 438 of the Administrative Rules. So our concept would revise Section 5 of the statute to provide further clarification regarding the board member's authority with respect to rulemaking. More specifically, it would allow the board members to revise existing rules or adopt new rules pertaining to electronic transmission of documents. I would note that the proposed statutory change is patterned after another section of the statute, which is Section 4, which grants the director of DCBS a similar authority. Our proposed amended statutory language would add this sentence to it. Notwithstanding any other provision of this chapter, the board may adopt rules to allow for the electronic transmissions of filings, reports, notices, and other documents required to be filed under the board's authority. So the proposed statutory change will provide clarity in two ways. First, it acknowledges that there's other statutory provisions in Chapter 656 which require physical mailing and original signatures on various important documents. For example, a request for hearing, a request for board review, a notification of CDA approval. Second, it would allow the board members to, through the rulemaking process and the public hearing process, to declare the terms mailing, filing, and signature to include electronic transmission of the type envisioned by the Oregon Uniform Electronic Transaction Act. Moreover, we believe that such clarity will preclude legal challenges to the board's rules and allow for electronics, filings, notices, and signatures. The benefits obtained in moving toward an electronic environment are several. This proposal will allow us through rulemaking to bring on electronic initiatives when WCB and DCBS have the technology in place and ready to proceed, and our stakeholders are willing to embrace these kinds of changes. For WCB, a fuller transition to electronic environment would result in more streamlined processes and procedures, which in turn should result in greater efficiencies and cost savings. For the users of our forum, they'd be able to convert their existing paper processes to electronic transmissions as well. And they too should be able to become more efficient in their communications with WCB and likewise see some cost savings. As noted by the committee administrator, NWAC has approved the proposed statutory change, and we have shared the statutory, our proposal with our stakeholders. They've expressed no objection, and the bill will have no fiscal impact on WCB. Those are all the comments I have, Madam Chair, and I want to thank you and members of the committee for allowing me to testify this morning. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? You must have been a very thorough job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, there's no one else signed up. Anybody else would like to speak on Senate Bill 190A? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 190A. And I'm going to wait until Fagan gets here before we do the other one.
Mm-hmm.
We'll wait until Senator Fagan gets here. Okay, I open a public hearing on Senate Bill 533.
Madam Chair, committee members, this measure extends the period during which a nurse practitioner may provide services to injured workers, modifies the authority of nurse practitioner and chiropractic physicians to provide services to injured workers who are enrolled in a managed care organization, requires the managed care organization to provide dispute resolution process for disputes between the organization and health care providers, except for those health care providers that are terminated from or denied participation in a plan, specifies conditions under which managed care organization may deny or terminate participation of the primary care physician, the chiropractic physician, or nurse practitioner in the organization. No amendments before you. Senate Bill 533 was approved by MLAC and passed the Senate 29-0. No revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. How about Sarah Basler and Vera Voss? John, are you here for questions or are you going to testify?
Testify now.
Okay, and then after that we'll have John and Vern Sabo. Thank you. Vern, do you want to come up with these two ladies?
Sure. Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 533. As you've just heard, Senate Bill 533 comes to you with unanimous approval from the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which has spent a significant amount of time over the past few years carefully considering provider authority issues with the goal of improving access to care for injured workers. As part of this process, MLAC has heard extensive input from a number of stakeholder groups, including nurse practitioners. Nurse practitioner authority within the workers' compensation system has varied over time, ranging from nurse practitioners being included as full providers to having significant limits on the time that they can treat injured workers. Currently, the workers' compensation system limits nurse practitioners to providing care to injured workers for 90 days, at which point they must transfer any workers' comp patients still in their care to a physician. They're also limited to authorizing time loss for 60 days, which in some cases can have the effect of requiring transfer to a physician before their 90-day timeline is up. In cases where a patient clearly needs to be, in cases where a patient needs specialty care, a nurse practitioner would transfer those patients to a specialist well before the 90-day timeline. As soon as it became clear that a specialist was the most appropriate person to be treating that patient. In a survey of nurse practitioners completed last fall, the timeline issue as well as the administrative hassle, which I know is an issue for a number of providers, rose to the top of challenges identified within the workers' compensation system. And while the time limits are certainly inconvenient from a provider standpoint, the larger issue is the challenges that they can pose for injured workers who, if they're treating with a nurse practitioner, once they get to the 90-day timeline, have to transfer to a physician. And in many cases, that can mean a wait time, travel time, and always establishing that patient-provider relationship with a new provider who's not familiar with their case. Oregon has a well-documented primary care provider shortage, and in some areas of the state, nurse practitioners are the only primary care providers. Expanding the timeline that nurse practitioners have to treat injured workers will improve access to care for workers' compensation patients. Additionally, the current limits on nurse practitioner authority and the workers' compensation system are inconsistent with data about nurse practitioner outcomes, which have consistently been shown to be comparable to physician outcomes. In a 2006 study by the Department of Consumer and Business Services Workers' Compensation Division on nurse practitioners as workers' compensation providers, it was found that there were no issues with workers' comp care provided by nurse practitioners, and during the time of the review, there had been no complaints about nurse practitioners as workers' compensation providers. The study found that authorizing nurse practitioners to provide care within the workers' compensation system improved access to care. Oregon nurse practitioners have historically demonstrated both inside and outside of the workers' compensation system that they are capable providers and a key part of our healthcare system. The limits currently in place in the workers' compensation system don't serve patients well, and ONA and NPO are pleased to encourage your support of Senate Bill 533. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vos?
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Vera Voss. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 533. I'm a family nurse practitioner currently in a practice, a small practice in Portland. I received my RN and FMP from OHSU and a special program in geriatric medicine at OHSU and mind-body medicine at Harvard School of Medicine. At my current practice, my colleagues and I, and those are both nurse practitioner and physician colleagues, we care for patients of all ages and for a variety of reasons, such as acute visits for illness or injury, chronic disease management, and wellness visits. The cornerstone of our practice is always the relationship that we form with our patients, which facilitates communication and the ability to foster health promotion and disease prevention. I have not personally had a lot of experience working with workman's comp claims prior to my current practice. I was working for Providence at a clinic in the southeast part of Portland. It was a residency clinic, and most of our workman's comp patients saw the residents mainly for experience on their part. But it was also due to the fact that I have a limit as to the time that I can see patients who have a workman's comp injury to 90 days. What I do know about workplace injury is that most are resolved within the 90-day period. Those that are more serious and require greater treatment than the primary care setting is able to provide are transferred early on to a specialist. In a few instances, there are reasons to extend the care beyond the 90 days. And as a nurse practitioner in Providence, it made more sense that the physician saw the patient. In other settings, that's difficult for patients. There are clinics that have only nurse practitioners. There are communities in Oregon that only have nurse practitioners. And for the few patients who do need care beyond the 90-day period, it does place a burden on the patient as well as increase the costs for the reasons that Sarah described. I think one of the most important factors of primary care, taking care of their own patient who's been injured at work, is that we have the knowledge of the patient's general health. So many injuries are, though they can be random, they also occur in the setting of other medical issues that the patient may be facing. Patients with chronic diseases tend to have more workplace injuries, and chronic disease management is a very strong component of primary care, as is health promotion and disease prevention, which together help to prevent workplace injuries. I feel very lucky and honored to practice in Oregon because our scope of practice is what it is, and this makes it much easier for me to provide the kind of care that I feel so strongly that our patients need. The current workman's comp restrictions are in contradiction to our general practice in Oregon. Thank you for listening, and I urge you to support this bill.
Okay, thank you. We'll hear from Dr. Sabo and then ask questions.
Thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sabo representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. This is a very simple provision for chiropractic physicians. Basically, if it's an established patient of ours and they are subsequently injured on the job and enrolled into a managed care organization that we're not on the panel, we're not on the list of doctors, many times a very short list, we can continue to treat that patient because they're an established patient. It makes perfect sense because when an injured worker or patient can select their provider, or injured worker can select their provider, the outcomes are always better, and even more so if it's a physician that they have a history with, and there's a trust, and many times they see their family members as well, so the outcomes tend to be better. And in addition to that, chiropractic physicians are a one-stop shop. We perform our own consultation, our examination. We're experts in the musculoskeletal evaluation of spine and extremities. We take and read our own X-rays. We perform our own hands-on treatment, actually put our hands on the patient and treat them. And the number one intervention is spinal manipulation, which the state of Oregon, it's the only non-pharmaceutical intervention the state of Oregon recommends for acute, subacute, and chronic low back pain, and that's one of the most expensive work-related injuries. So I would urge your aye vote, and I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you very much for your time. Those were the only ones signed up. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on Senate Bill 533A? Okay, if not, since
this John.
Oh, I forgot about we have one John signed up, not the other one, but I apologize for overlooking you guys. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. John Molas with the Oregon State Building Trades Council. This morning, I'm before your committee, I'm wearing my hat that is the labor co-chair of the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee, or MLAC. And about 2 years ago, MLAC formed a subcommittee to take a look at medical access issues for injured workers. And we did this in part because in 2011, there was some legislation introduced that didn't pass that looked at different provider expanding authority for different providers. And so we thought we'd step back and take a more comprehensive look at the system and take a look at all of the issues that might be of concern not only to injured workers, but we were seeing some providers that were leaving the system as well. We met, I believe, 11 times over the last couple years. We received input from providers, from injured workers, from the whole host of individuals and organizations that are involved in the workers' comp system. We also conducted a survey of health care providers in conjunction with SAFE and the Oregon Medical Association. And based on all that input in the committee hearings, we made a number of recommendations for changes. Some of them don't require statutory changes. For example, we've asked the division to try and find ways to make it easier for providers to get paid, to standardize paperwork, and to set standards for electronic billing. And we've also asked the department to take a look at a couple longer range issues, such as some peer mentorship programs to try and encourage providers to consider becoming a workers' comp provider in the system. And then we've recommended some changes that we feel will improve access for injured workers, particularly those in rural Oregon where access is more of a problem. And for the intricacies, I'm going to now turn it over to John Schultz with the division, who can speak better to the details than I can. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
John?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you've heard quite a bit about the bill itself, and I'll keep my comments as brief as possible, but I did want to touch on a couple of the details of the bill. First, just a quick background. Under workers' compensation law, a variety of providers have different levels of authority to act as the gatekeeper or attending physician on a workers' compensation claim. We also have managed care organizations, or MCOs, as they're often referred to, unique to the workers' compensation system. And MCOs have broad authority to manage medical care for injured workers, including allowing providers to act as attending physicians for time periods greater than the law allows. Now, specifically, this bill will not interfere with that ability of MCOs to allow providers to act as attending physicians for time periods that are greater than what the law allows for non-MCO enrolled workers. Now, to the bill itself, more specifically, this bill, as you heard, it extends the period of nurse practitioner authority to treat and authorize time loss for injured workers. It also allows workers who are enrolled in a managed care organization to bring along their chiropractic physician for the first time. A couple of comments on that. The bill allows the worker, when they're enrolled in the MCO, to get their health care treatment from a non-panel chiropractic physician, as has already been described. The chiropractic physician must maintain the worker's medical records and have a documented history of treating that worker, and then the chiropractic physician must agree to comply with all the MCO terms, rules, and conditions. The bill will allow an MCO to deny or terminate authorization of a non-panel primary care physician, authorized nurse practitioner, or chiropractic physician to serve as the attending physician if within 2 years of the worker's enrollment in the MCO, the provider failed to meet or comply with the terms and conditions of the MCO contract or to meet the MCO's credentialing standards. And that's rather detailed, but I wanted to get that on the record. That's the MCOs have some authority here as well. And finally, I'd like to mention that this bill is going to allow an authorized healthcare provider, whether they're a nurse practitioner, chiropractic physician, or some other provider, to appeal to the director if they are dissatisfied with an action of the MCO regarding provision of the medical services as that come-along provider. The bill also requires MCOs to report to DCBS denials and revocations for come-along providers in order that we are going to be able to evaluate if there's problems in this area after enacting the bills, and then our plan is to report that out to MLAC on an annual basis. And other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. Any questions? Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. Ms. Mullis, I just want to thank you and MPAC for taking a real effort to making a real effort to come to terms with something that has been a discrepancy and an inequity for a long time.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schultz, we had just heard testimony in the previous panel that the list of providers on some of the panels, and I presume the reference was to MCO panels, were very short. Do you know why they're very short?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, we have looked into this issue. In fact, it's an issue that we regulate on a regular basis. We require that there is a minimum amount of providers in each geographic service area that the MCOs provide service in. In some of those areas, I think this is the primary reason, it's hard to recruit physicians who are willing to be on the MCO panel for reasons that physicians don't want to make that agreement. Second, there may be a low number of physicians available in that geographic service area. And then third, there a lot of physicians don't want to treat workers' compensation. It's a administratively intense area of practice. And there's a lot of paperwork for them. And that's one of the issues we're trying to grapple with. Another comment that I would make is that I think in certain areas of the state, the issue has primarily been about chiropractic physicians being able to get onto the MCO panels. What we ask the MCOs to do is report to us their efforts in recruitment of physicians of all types onto their panels. And primarily the recruitment efforts that we oversee are aggressive. They're trying to recruit physicians. They don't succeed in some of the areas in Oregon, some better than others. And then the MCOs themselves have testified in front of MLAC that another reason that they keep some of the panels short in some of the areas is they have, in their estimation, enough panel members to cover that area for the number of workers that they're covering. And they also cite the expense of recruiting and then certifying those providers is high for them. And so if they feel like they have enough providers to do the job, then they don't want to overstaff the panels because of the expense. So that's primarily what I think my comments would be. I'm not sure, Jonathan.
No, I can say that's fine. Yeah.
Comment?
Mm-hmm.
It just appears to me that you've described a series of barriers to many of the MCO panels. And that from the injured worker's perspective, there's not the broad array of provider services that we're, I presume initially envisioned when MCOs were established. And if that's the case, then it might be prudent for MLAC to take a look at those barriers and how those barriers might be reduced.
Any other comments or questions, Representative Holthe?
Thank you. Following up on Representative Witt's questions, I'm wondering, you had mentioned that one of the reasons they would restrict the number of providers on a panel is the cost of having a larger panels. I'm trying to understand why there would be an increase in cost to having a larger group of providers available for the public to choose from, and you know, it seems going back, it seems sort of restrictive to say, well, we've got enough providers to cover this population, when in fact there might be lots of providers willing to do that. What do they base and to follow up with that, what do they base a denial, I suppose, for a provider to participate in a panel? I mean, what's the reasoning for saying, well, we're not going to allow you to be on the panel if a provider wanted to be on a panel?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, primarily when those issues come to the department from providers who have been denied, after seeking to become a panel member, it's either primarily that the MCO feels like they either have enough panel representation in that geographic service area, as I mentioned before, or secondly, they've had issues with that particular provider. And the expense issue for them, and the MCOs can speak to this better than I can, but the expense issue for them is not just in the recruitment or opening panel membership up to physicians. There's some cost in that and time spent doing the recruitment. But then the credentialing process itself, as I have seen it, is pretty extensive. It's not the same in every MCO, but it's extensive in every MCO that we have, where they are trying to establish the credentials of the physician. For an issue, as an example that comes to mind, is this person currently under any sort of disciplinary action by their licensing board? Might be an issue, and so doing that, and that's just an example. Doing that credentialing, as I understand it, is not an easy or inexpensive process for the MCOs, and so those are the issues we hear quite a bit about in terms of why the panel issue is not just an open panel. The other issue, I think, is that primarily when an insurance company or an employer is making a decision to enroll workers, contract with an MCO, part of that decision-making process is, have they carefully picked a panel of providers that are going to provide quality care to the worker, as well as they've agreed to do that as inexpensively as possible for them. There's an argument to be made that if it's an open panel situation where anybody can join an MCO panel, the MCO cannot have that as something that they're trying to bring forward to their customer base in the market. It makes it very difficult for them, because how do they then say we have the select panel who we know can provide quality care, we know who can do that less expensively, when any panel provider is allowed on? So that's an argument that we hear as well.
Any other questions, Representative Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comment would just be that it's always a trade-off between controlling costs and providing services. But again, if it is true, as the testimony that we just received before the two of you, is that there are very short panels, I'm very concerned that we're sacrificing a broad array of treatment options for injured people to save a buck, and that's concerning.
Okay. Any other comments or questions?
Can I make one more remark, Madam Chair? I was probably remiss in my earlier comments not to give some thanks that are certainly due. So my management co-chair, Kathy Nishimoto, all the other members of MLAC from both sides of the table, like I said, met 11 times over the last couple of years, spent a lot of time as volunteers, and to John Schultz, Teresa Van Winkle, who's in the back of the room, and all the other workers' comp division staffers that when we said, can we have this data to look at? And they go, yeah, we can find that for you.
Okay.
So thanks to all of them very much.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
For noting that. Okay. Anything else? If not, I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 533, and I open up a work session on Senate Bill 533.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 533A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 533A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Bagans.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Excused.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Do we have a carrier on this bill? Anyone would like to carry it? Okay, Representative Witt. Okay. With that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 533 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 190.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 198 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves the Senate Bill 198 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Excused.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Bacon.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kennedy.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Thurman.
Okay, aye. Okay, the motion passes. Do we have a carrier on this bill?
I'll do it.
Okay, Representative Kennemer. Okay, with that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 190. That concludes our business for today. Anything else? Reminder, we're not meeting on Friday. I know it's...
Break our hearts, but...
Hold your tears. But anyway, have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.